Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, and later on Building Bridges, farm workers demand investigation of grower threats and intimidation in union election with Arturo Rodriguez, president of the United Farm Workers of America.
But first...
Everybody knew that it could happen. The likelihood was clear, the future was coming. Now it's here. Had to fix the levees, because otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ. What would happen when the big one hit?
We were going to be talking about, really is the storm after the storm, with the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We wanted to do a special on New Orleans that began to look at the issue of the right of displaced residents of New Orleans to return to homes with jobs, rebuilding the city through the equivalent of a domestic Marshall Plan. Will the people who finally inherit again New Orleans be the gentry, or will it actually be the people who created the culture of that city? And the issue really is beginning to have the collective demands on government that assure that the evacuees, that the victims of Katrina and the victims of the gross negligence of the federal government to date are at some point made whole again.
Congress approved $50 billion to rebuild New Orleans, but the question is, who's going to get that money? What is that money going to be used for? Who's going to get that jobs? Is it just going to be Halliburton? Is it going to be Bechtel? Who's going to get the jobs at what wage rate, because the prevailing wages have been cut by the Bush administration? What is this money going to go for? Who's going to get it? Are the poor going to get it? Are the unemployed going to get it? What about unemployment insurance? What about jobs and housing now for the people of New Orleans?
Here we are, in the richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth.
And now, a special with the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We have been diligently trying to get him. He has been in the air. He just touched down in New Orleans. Jesse Jackson, how are things in New Orleans from your perspective at this time?
Well, things are very chaotic. There was no mass plan for emergency evacuation. There's also been no reasonable, rational plan for relocation. Relocation has been dislocation. The people in New Orleans are now in 34 states. It's a massive dispersion of people. It has tremendous social, political, and economic effect, for example, on the people that are being dispersed across the country. Federal governments formally for giving money and gives the most access to Bechtel and to Halliburton and major corporations. The disaster area victims do not have any difference of priority on contracts or jobs, and 150,000 are still in shelters, living on floors, catching communicable diseases. And so you don't have the dramatic pictures you have of people at the convention center, but we're still in the storm.
A major concern is, we were almost calling it the right to return. Will the displaced be able to come back? Will there be the demands that the tenant community reoccupy New Orleans with housing at affordable rents? Will there be, and are there being, the construction of demands for jobs for this displaced population to come back and be able to live?
There is no such plan right now. That's what we're meeting tonight in Baton Rouge with political and religious leaders, to construct such a plan so that disaster relief victims will have priority on job training and job construction. When Bush and the Congress passed this rush to bill, they suspended Davis-Bacon, for example, so as to leave workers more vulnerable. They ran it through so as to give small businesses, which is basically the Gulf Coast businesses, no priority, and so the Bechtels and the Halliburtons got all of the big deals. 37% of New Orleans are homeowners, 63% was renters. When they do the cleanup, as I suspect they will do, it means that those who own the rented properties will get a higher price on their investment. And so unless there's some government intervention to protect those who once were renters, they'll be gentrified out of here. Most local state officials and business people and local political officials to get some kind of game plan.
Reverend Jackson, Mimi mentioned a domestic Marshall Plan. I'd like to mention a Works Projects Administration where the government takes over some of this duty of reconstruction, not contract out so much, and hires the people from New Orleans to rebuild New Orleans.
Earlier today, we met in Memphis with about 300 ministers, Bishop Vashti McKenzie and other bishops of the church and political leaders, on looking at a comprehensive plan. And among other things, we went at a press conference at a former Army depot in Memphis. We have 300 FEMA contracted trucks that have been there for a whole week without any place to go. Full trucks, paying them $1,000 a day per truck and $2,000 a week for gas. And there are several depots around the country of loaded trucks of product without any distribution point to get them to people that need them. Down in Liberty, Mississippi, and Macomb, Mississippi yesterday, down in the rural areas, and the lights are still not on. People are in the dark and cannot get medicine, no food, no water. So in some sense, the drama is not there with people walking through the waters, but we're still in the storm, and we're going to fight for a victims first form of reconstruction.
Reverend Jackson, the Democratic Party, have they responded to this crisis to your satisfaction, the spokespeople in the Democratic Party in Congress?
No, they've just been weak. I mean, almost Republican light. I mean, I saw one or two come and wave their hands. I've not seen any formula. We see at work here the right-wing, states' rights, anti-worker, anti-civil rights ideology at work. We don't see the strong resistance, I don't, by those who would dare be Democrat leaders in the year 2008. Where are they with a point of view with strength when we need them? We know that on the emotions of the moment last Friday, they ran to a $50 bill, but they suspended the rules on affirmative action, on small businesses, on disadvantaged businesses, on the workers' rights to organize. They suspended the rules in the name of we've got to have the money. No, they ran to a scheme to allow the big consultants and the big corporations to just rip the people off. And so that was the right-wing point of view, but it's the alternative and clear Democratic point of view. I'm not pleased with Democrats, and I'm not scared of Republicans. I am very displeased.
Reverend Jackson, we've been calling it a domestic Marshall Plan that's needed in order to rebuild New Orleans for those people that created the culture and built that city. Do you think that we can assist in those who've taken the leadership in moving in that direction? And is that too melodramatic? Is that too grandiose to think of it as a, will we be able to implement that?
We do need a domestic master plan, but the people from the reconstruction area must be built into that formula by law, not by whims, yes, not by perchance. They must build into that formula the affected area. The small businesses, or the poor, the black folks, they're giving out contracts, $100 million contracts, with the 20% minorities. In New Orleans, the minority is 80%, the ethnic minority. You know, so we should be getting those contracts, not subsets. I mean, a minority contract is white in New Orleans. There must be a sense of fairness and proportionality.
I think that we just think of New Orleans as Mississippi was hit harder, I may add, than New Orleans was. New Orleans has just got to take a double hit, and the hurricane. But New Orleans, Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi. For the life of me, I would never accept the idea that the governor refused to use her powers to have massive relocation in northern Louisiana. You've got unused military bases, the English Air Force base in Alexandria. You've got the Bell Chase base in New Orleans. You have state properties and federal land properties, and I submit to you that the people here were not willing to, in fact,
shift New Orleans north,
and therefore the dispersed this population. Fundamentally unfair and wrong. Louisiana taxpayers should have had their first option staying in their own state, and that was no such plan for them.
Reverend Jackson, you sound tired. I know you're on the way to a meeting. What can we do? What are the demands that we should have to supplement, to support what you're trying to accomplish?
We have to make very public leadership demands for us to give clarity, because if not, the masses will simply be waiting to read in the paper and watch TV, and now there's no light from waiting. We must demand a Gulf region first set of priorities, demand that workers have a right, demand that the small businesses have rights, that disadvantaged businesses have rights, that we stop the letting of contracts until the people here are included. And we plan to put together that demand structure tonight.
Jesse Jackson, again, you're very much on target. We hope you get some rest. Thank you for pushing ahead. We will continue to keep in touch with these critical efforts to bring this brief interview with the Reverend Jackson, indeed a WPA, a domestic Marshall Plan. We must have the people who live there return at affordable rents, remuneration of property, personal and private, and there have to be the jobs.
They're going to use this crisis to push through their agenda in any number of different ways. As the Reverend Jackson said, people will move hundreds, thousands of miles when they could have been kept in the area. They don't want people back. They're going to put people to work who they want to work at the wages they want them to work for, with no unions, no prevailing wage rates. They're going to build housing back where they want it to be, not for the people. They're going to use this catastrophe for their own purposes. And no matter how much money is allocated by Congress, we have to watch the way it's going to be spent.
And we have to make sure when we're in Washington on the 24th, when we're in Washington for the Million More March, and when the headlines have faded, that we keep on with this watershed in our history to make sure that our sisters and brothers in the Gulf Coast states have employment, have affordable housing, and that, as Ken said, the money is used for their benefit and not for the corporate elite.
New Orleans.
This is Here. It is our sisters and brothers, the issue of race, the issue of class, have come together, and we have an absolute obligation to make our sisters and brothers whole again. This is our responsibility.
New Orleans. New Orleans. New Orleans. New Orleans.
Well, now we take a look at, well, I don't know, I'm tempted to say almost always the terribly beleaguered, yet proud, and always struggling farm workers of this country. Farm workers, in this case, are demanding an investigation of the growers' threats and intimidation in a union election in Guayamara Vineyards, which is the world's largest table grape grower with 4,000 peak season workers. Two farm workers have died from extreme heat laboring at Guayamara. Workers have been forced to labor 8 hours a day on their knees with no protection against the sun, low pay, and speed-ups. Well, the United Farm Workers of America is now in the midst of an organizing drive with these farm workers. It is the largest organizing drive since the 1970s, and to tell us more about its significance is Arturo Rodriguez, president of the United Farm Workers of America, and it is always quite a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk to all your listenership. I know all throughout the Northeast, and particularly in the New York area, we've had tremendous support throughout the year, so it's a real honor to be able to reach your audience and to be able to answer some of the questions and share with them in terms of what's going on with United Farm Workers these days.
We definitely want to talk about the election, but let us first figure out what the conditions of these farm workers are. This massive unit, I think it's 4,000 workers at its peak in the summer. Tell us more about the workers in the, how do we pronounce this now?
Guayamara Vineyards. And it's located here in the San Joaquin Valley, primarily in two counties, Kern County in the Bakersfield area and in the Tulare County area. And, you know, they are been in business now for 75 years. They really pride themselves not only being on the largest but the highest quality grape. But the problem has always been is even though their grape is the highest quality, they've never treated their workers like workers that are professionals, that workers that work with dignity and respect and really provide a quality product to them. What's transpired there over the years is just unbelievable when you think about we're in a new century now, And yet this farm is the only grower that I know of that still has their farm workers packing the table grapes, the grapes that you get in the stores, the green grapes, the red grapes, and they have them packing on their knees all day long. And so they wake up in the morning, they go to work, they start work at 6:30 a.m., and they're working out there in the hot sun, and oftentimes it's up above 110 degrees over there in the fields where they're working at. And at the end of the day, their jeans or their pants, both for the women and for the men, are just caked with mud from all day long kneeling down there. And then as time goes on, they got all kinds of arthritic condition because of kneeling there all day long and packing those grapes 8 to 10 hours a day.
Arturo, let me just ask you, since you said this is somewhat unique now, what are the other mechanisms at other venues for picking those grapes?
The majority of the table grape growers have gone to allowing workers to pack on tables that they set up in the fields, mm-hmm. portable tables, and they actually have an umbrella that props over the top of that table so it shades the worker that's over there packing. And they're standing up, and they're doing that in a much better situation than, again, that worker that's on their knees.
I'm just trying to understand this. That seems to be so, I mean, it's low tech, it's so simplistic. Why is this an issue?
Jamara Vineyards, you know, their owners say that this allows... One, I mean, it cuts the cost because then they don't have to worry about providing this equipment. They don't have to worry about when they move from one field to another, they have to move this equipment then. In their eyes, it's all about cost. It's not about how
a table and an umbrella.
Exactly.
Oh, goodness.
And the umbrella, I assume, might have prevented some of these deaths that we've seen during the very hot days.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you have the workers that are out there 8 to 10 hours. I mean, the other problem that's been there, that's occurred there is that they set quotas for the workers. So they have to pick so many boxes of grapes. And a box of grapes, Ken, is about 23 pounds. And so it's, you know, that's fairly heavy, especially when you have to pick at least and carry at least 5 to 10 boxes per hour. And so these workers are working at a horrific pace and with the heat going on. So for them to maintain their quota, oftentimes they skip breaks. They don't drink water like they should. They skimp on their lunch. They do whatever they need to do to make the quota because the foremen are over there telling them that if they don't make their quota, they're fired and workers cannot afford to be without a job. They've got their families to take care of and everything else. That's another issue that we definitely have to deal with at that particular company.
I'm still back at the tables and the umbrellas because it's so de minimis. I mean, we can begin to debate and understand more about the speed-ups. We can understand more about low pay, pesticides, various other issues that I know you're going to elaborate on. But an umbrella and a table, even this absolutely insignificant in some ways, obviously not so insignificant to the workers, but de minimis kind of consideration of the workers is too much? Is this company that virulent, that mean-spirited and ugly to the workers? I mean, is there something fundamental to this company?
Well, you know, the employers there, we've fought them since the first grape boycott that actually this coming weekend.
You mean the first grape boycott?
The first grape boycott back in 1965. This employer has been having their workers work on their knees all this time. It's been a fight throughout the last 40 years that we've been engaged in this. This time around, I mean, the workers made a valiant effort in terms of making this thing happen. But, of course, the employer, when they see this coming, they go out there and the family just does, and they've done it time and again, a real major campaign of intimidation, of coercion, of threatening the workers with their jobs and closing the camps down where the workers live at and all these kinds of things that set the stage for not getting quite over 50% of the vote.
And two workers died. The circumstances behind those deaths?
The first worker was last year, July 28th of 2004. Again, the temperature that particular day soared beyond 105 degrees on the outside. In the fields, it even intensifies more because of the humidity from the irrigation that's being provided to the plants, to the grapevines. And so Asuncion Valdivia, he was a 51-year-old farm worker. It was towards the end of his day. It was around 4:30 in the afternoon, and he was trying to meet the quotas. And as a result, by that time, he just fell down right there in the vineyards, and the foreman took him and dragged him under a vine, left him there. They applied some water to his forehead and began to see that he revived a little bit. In the meantime, they were trying to call an emergency vehicle. They were disconnected, and they said, oh, well, He's going to be okay now. He's starting to revive. They sent him home with his 21-year-old son, Luis, who's also working in that particular field alongside of his dad, and tell Luis to take your dad home. He's sick. He can't work anymore. Maybe tomorrow he'll be better. They didn't even bother to really see what the impact was. And Luis, as he's driving home, taking his dad, he has to drive another hour and a half to get home. And the road there, his father begins to vomit and to go into convulsions there. Luis panics, immediately takes him to a hospital, and the doctor takes him inside to the examining room. Within 10 minutes, Asuncion is dead. And to this day, the employer has never apologized, has never said anything to the family, never offered his condolences, never did anything to help the family deal with all the expenses that were involved. We had to step in there and do everything to really take care of the situation for Asuncion's family as a result of that death there. And then this year, the same thing occurred again in one of John Jamara's fields. In this particular case, it was in another type of crop where the worker was working out there, got overwhelmed by the heat that was there because, again, they were speeding up the workers there and died right there in the fields. And then beside that, it happened to four other workers in other parts of the San Joaquin Valley here where those deaths occurred. It's insane. I mean, these types of things have never occurred. We've been fighting this since 1990. And as a result of all these deaths that occurred this year, finally through the heroic efforts of the Jamara workers, we were able to get emergency regulations passed by the governor of the state of California in order to be able to provide more drinking water and to provide shaded rest areas and to train foremen and supervisors to recognize these situations and do something. But the most important thing was is that a farm worker now has the opportunity to go to their foreman or supervisor and tell them if they feel ill that I need a break without any fear of retaliation or intimidation against him for taking that action. A lot of efforts going into all this, but there's still a tremendous amount of work to do.
And so true to form, these bosses who put the workers through all of this in the fields, resulting in deaths because of minimal costs that they really don't want to bear, are fighting you tooth and nail in this union election. You're saying to the Agriculture Relations Board in California that intimidation, that all kinds of threats are made. Why don't you flesh that out for us?
You know, and it's no secret to anybody. A significant part of the farm labor force today are undocumented workers. They're immigrants that come here from Mexico. They have the skills, they have the talent, and they have the energy to do agriculture work because nobody else in this country necessarily wants to do that kind of work because it doesn't pay and you get treated totally with disrespect. So consequently, farm workers migrate here to be able to do that work, but then the Jamaras and a lot of other employers take advantage of those workers and don't pay them the wages and they threaten them. And in this particular situation, they have at least 10 different labor camps where the workers live. So what they started doing right 2 days before the election took place, they went around to all those workers in the labor camps and said, okay, we're going to shut down the labor camps if the union wins. All the workers that were undocumented, they told them, we're going to fire you from your jobs if the union wins. And then they went and told the truck drivers that this company will not stay as it is if the union wins. We will break it up into small units, and you'll never have a job here again at this company. And then went on and on like that, intimidating those workers, threatening them with loss of employment, which for those workers, they can't afford not to work. They've got families to take care of, families to ensure that they've got housing and everything else that's needed while they're working in the fields here. And so consequently, it inevitably results in a situation whereby, you know, you come very close to winning or it's very difficult to overcome those types of situations.
And the farm workers did decide to petition to have an election, despite the threats and despite the intimidation by Chamada. Let's find out exactly what happened with that process.
On Friday was the day that we had to formally file the objections with the State Agricultural Labor Relations Board, and we did that. And then a group of workers went to Sacramento, California, where the main offices are for the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, and they personally went, along with other farm workers, to go there and to ensure that the copy, the information, the charges that we filed were actually provided directly there to the secretary for the Agricultural Labor Relations Board to ensure that they had the information and to encourage them and to urge them to go out there and do the type of investigation that's necessary so that workers do not get intimidated or coerced into losing their jobs there at the employer. And from my understanding is they were met, welcomed. When they got there to Sacramento, they went ahead and filed the papers. They talked directly with the Secretary General there at the Agricultural Labor Relations Board offices, and they're receiving an assurance from them that they are going to take these charges very seriously, that they're going to do the investigation necessary, and that they will ensure that the law is upheld in this particular situation. So these workers and, of course, UFW will continue to put all the pressure necessary to make sure that this happens.
And I know that people are going to want to contact you to help. What's the website for the United Farm Workers? How can people get in touch?
You know, they should go ahead and they can tune into our website, which is www.ufw.org. Or if they want to send us an email directly, they could send it to execoffice@ufwmail.com, and we'll get the information. And again, we want to always thank everyone that supported us, not only through our internet campaigns and through our boycotts, but there are a significant number of individuals throughout the New York area, New Jersey area, that have been very responsive to our request for monetary assistance throughout the years, and we're very, very appreciative to all those folks. And we thank you because all that money goes into the organizing efforts of the United Farm Workers.
Arturo Rodriguez, we commend you as always for your vigilance, your undaunted advocacy on behalf of workers, specifically the farm workers. And we have been speaking with Arturo Rodriguez, president of the United Farm Workers of America.
Mimi and Ken, we want to thank you both as well for all the tremendous work that you do and the information that you get out to your listenership. And we, in a special way, want to thank all the listeners for all the support that you've given us throughout the years and continue to give us. Si se puede.
Si se puede. And this is Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Después de 2 semanas, para unirse a la batalla, salieron los mexicanos.